Monster Man, special episode, When the Dungeon is the Dragon.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular the generosity and public spirit of Patreon backer Bob. If you'd like to be like Bob and get your own special episode of Monster Man, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to a custom episode, you'll also get access to my other show, Patron Deities, which has just started a new season all about Babylonian mythology, plus you'll get some occasional bonus content that I release for all of my Patreon supporters. So Bob, thank you very much for supporting Monster Man, and I hope that you enjoy your episode. Bob has asked me to talk about psychoactive landscapes and buildings, like when you think the house is haunted, but the house is actually psychically charged in some fashion. So we're talking about living landscapes, living structures, and places that are themselves the monster. I'm going to break this down into a couple of rough categories, but realistically, these are going to overlap a good deal. First, I want to talk about quote-unquote haunted houses. Secondly, I want to talk about cursed landscapes. And thirdly, I want to talk about applying this specifically to the idea of a dungeon. Let's start with haunted houses. Now, it might seem superficially that there is not very much difference between a house that has a ghost in it and a house that is a ghost, a house that is haunted by some presence, or a house that is itself kind of corrupted and evil. But actually, I want to suggest that there is a very important difference. A lot of fantasy and some traditional horror rests on the idea that evil and horror are intrusions into a normal world. We can see this in the haunted house genre, which creates horror by bringing the source of the uncanny into the most normal environment you can think of, right? The home, the ultimate scene of normality and domesticity. And you can see this in the kind of relentlessly normal, and I want to give a shout out, this insight comes from Bela Lugosi's Shed, a podcast about horror in all its chilling forms. They were talking the other day about Poltergeist and about how kind of like very grounded in American 80s consumer culture it is. And I think that that's, you know, exactly why it is the way that it is. That represents domesticity and security for that audience. And the haunting of such a place is a violation of boundaries. Home is the inside. It's the place where my family and I are safe from the things that are dangerous, which are outside. So for the dangerous things to come into the inside, that's a violation of boundaries. The danger has come into my house. But for the danger to be my house itself is what Sandy Peterson once called revolutionary horror. I want to say it was Sandy Peterson. If it turned out to be somebody else, then I apologize. But I think it was Sandy Peterson who called this revolutionary horror. So the realization is that not only has an unsafe thing come into my safe interior world, but actually that interior world was never safe. The home is itself the source of threat. And this, of course, is an analogy for a process that a lot of us go through as we grow up, when we realize that the things that we thought of as normal, that the things that we thought of as safe when we were children, are in fact illusion, when you realize that everyone's just making it up as they go along. We adapt to that, of course, but it can be a difficult process. Now, maybe this structure was always that way. That's the house in Poltergeist, right? Built on a Native American burial ground, which of course is in a way symbolic of the sin that's at the heart of America. Built on a Native American burial ground. Again, thanks to the hosts of Bela Lugosi's Shed. Or maybe something happened to it. And this sort of falls between the more traditional ghost story and the psychically active house. That there was some evil presence, some terrible event, some dark ritual, whatever. And now that has infected the house, corrupted it, left some residue, some radiation that has turned the place itself malevolent. I think when you make it a house, in a fantasy setting, I feel like there are fewer ways that you can make an ordinary house terrifying. Because Assuming we're going with a kind of pseudo-medieval fantasy setting, most medieval structures are relatively straightforward. The only thing a poltergeist can do to you, the only thing a house that wants to kill you can do to you, is pretty much collapse on you or catch on fire. But once you get into the more complex internal landscape of, say, a castle, which is of course the ultimate symbol of a home that keeps the dangers of the outside world away from you, I think you can do some interesting stuff. You know, you can have drawbridges dropping people into the moats and portcullises landing on people and, you know, doors refusing to open so that people get stuck at the tops of tall towers and locked in cellars and so forth, right? I think there's a little bit more to play with in a castle landscape. And of course, castles are traditionally signs of horror. And maybe this is for a poltergeist reason. Maybe the castle was built, there's some flaw at its heart. You know, this good king built the castle, but actually, you know, buried beneath it are the people he murdered to take the throne. Or something like that. It represents that the castle, which is the symbol of the reign, is unsound in the way that the reign is unsound. This can justify a two-tiered scenario, right? Because the first time that you visit the castle, you're like, oh, this castle is haunted. We need to get rid of the monster. And then you realize that it's actually the castle itself that is the monster. Maybe it even produces monsters. Maybe the people who live in it degenerate under its influence. You thought like, oh, well, we got rid of that bad king. But then the good princess takes over, and yet she begins to go through the same process, right? It's not the people that made the place evil, but the place that made the people evil. So that's your haunted house. Quote-unquote haunted. Second, we have the cursed landscape. Now, you know, if you want to understand the horror of place, I think stipulating all the usual reservations about his bigotry and the important role that plays in his work, I do think that no one really gets the horror of place, maybe Algernon Blackwood, but nobody really gets the horror of place like H.P. Lovecraft. Lovecraft was very concerned with these kind of cursed landscapes, with the idea that the thing that is wrong is all around you, is inescapable, or maybe escapable if you're the narrator who's just visiting, but not for the people who are there. I'm going to quickly read you a couple of excerpts from stories by H.P. Lovecraft. This first one comes from The Dunwich Horror. When a traveler in north central Massachusetts takes the wrong fork at the junction of the Aylesbury Pike just beyond Dean's Corners, he comes upon a lonely and curious country. The ground gets higher, and the briar-bordered stone walls press closer and closer against the ruts of the dusty curving road. The trees of the frequent forest belt seem too large, and the wild weeds, brambles, and grasses attain a luxuriance not often found in settled regions. At the same time, the planted fields appear singularly few and barren, while the sparsely scattered houses wear a surprisingly uniform aspect of age, squalor, and dilapidation. Without knowing why, one hesitates to ask directions from the gnarled, solitary figures spied now and then on crumbling doorsteps or on the sloping, rock-strewn meadows. Those figures are so silent and furtive that one feels somehow confronted by forbidden things with which it would be better to have nothing to do. When a rise in the road brings the mountains in view above the deep woods, the feeling of strange uneasiness is increased. The summits are too rounded and symmetrical to give a sense of comfort and naturalness, and sometimes the sky silhouettes with a special clearness the queer circles of tall stone pillars with which most of them are crowned. Later he goes on to say, outsiders visit Dunwich as seldom as possible, and since a certain season of horror, all the signboards pointing toward it have been taken down. The scenery, judged by any ordinary aesthetic canon, is more than commonly beautiful, yet there is no influx of artists or summer tourists. 2 centuries ago, when talk of witch blood, Satan worship, and strange forest presences was not laughed at, it was the custom to give reasons for avoiding the locality. In our sensible age, since the Dunwich Horror of 1928 was hushed up by those who had the town's and the world's welfare at heart, people shun it without knowing exactly why. And then again later on, no one, even those who have the facts concerning the recent horror, can say just what is the matter with Dunwich. Or how about this one from The Color Out of Space? West of Arkham the hills rise wild, and there are valleys with deep woods that no axe has ever cut. There are dark, narrow glens where the trees slope fantastically, and where thin brooklets trickle without ever having caught the glint of sunlight. On the gentler slopes there are farms, ancient and rocky, with squat, moss-coated cottages brooding eternally over old New England secrets in the lee of great ledges. But these are all vacant now, the wide chimneys crumbling and the shingled sides bulging perilously beneath low gambrel roofs. The old folk have gone away, and foreigners do not like to live there. French Canadians have tried it, Italians have tried it, and the Poles have come and departed. It is not because of anything that can be seen or heard or handled, but because of something that is imagined. The place is not good for the imagination and does not bring restful dreams at night. The haunted landscape, I think, is so important in Lovecraft because for Lovecraft, I think, sense of identity and place were very closely connected. Think about his tombstone, right? I am Providence. So if you are where you come from, if you are your heritage, right, this is also a theme that occurs to the kind of eugenic connotations of Lovecraft's work, but if you are from that place, but there's something wrong with that place, then what does that say about you? I like the idea of a cursed landscape in a D&D world because it allows us to square some of the different images that people like to have in fantasy worlds yet that don't necessarily coexist very easily. A good example of this in a piece of fantasy literature would be the Land of Mordor in the works of J.R.R. Tolkien. Because I think that one of the things that people like about Tolkien is, you know, good versus evil, heroes versus monsters, all that kind of stuff. And yet I also think they like the bucolic romanticism of, you know, the Shire and hobbits and all that kind of thing. But in order for those two things to coexist, you have to have a bad place, a kind of hell on earth, somewhere that monsters can come from. And I think it's not hard to say, well, what if Sauron is the Land of Mordor? You know, what if his essence is distributed entirely throughout that place, right? He's not a physical being. He's seeped into the rocks and the rivers, and there is just a blight upon it. And this is great because it gives you a three-tiered quest structure from just one location, right? When we start out, we are all in our fantasy villages and castles and whatever, and we're heading off into the wilderness to explore ancient ruins and blah, blah, blah. We all know that monsters come out of the haunted forest. And so we are fighting to keep our little villages and castles free of the monsters that come out of the haunted forest. You know, a bunch of level one types taking their grandma's rusty longsword down off of the cabin wall, or tucking their prayer book into their satchel and picking up their mace to go out and, you know, be the one that keeps all these goblins away from the simple folk who just want to live their lives in peace and quiet. Then when we're maybe a little higher level, okay, now we have to venture into the haunted forest. You know, where the spiders are going to come down from the treetops and strange old women live in mysterious huts whose fences are made of bones, you know. So we can go from protecting the outside world from this place to having to venture into it. And you can mess around with it as much as you like, right? Like, we can do some stalker type of stuff. And that'll be fun too. And then we have our highest tier thing once we're, you know, shining heroes and the Queen of the Elves has placed the gilded crown upon our brows and whatever. Now we can go in there and try to actually solve whatever is wrong with the haunted forest, de-haunt the haunted forest. And it'll mean more to us because way back at level one, when we were keeping the goblins out of the old mill, we remember the haunted forest as the place that was the sum of all those innocent, hardworking people's fears. This is also a great place to put all of those malevolent plants that we've been talking about, because think about it, a lot of that stuff, from a strictly ecological perspective, didn't make a whole lot of sense, right? There are very few things that make a living killing and eating human-sized creatures. That's a tough row to hoe. But if there is a malevolent consciousness underneath this thing, right? If that's where they buried the Dark Lord centuries ago, and, you know, wouldn't you know it, as the roots of the trees reached into his sepulcher, they picked up some of his evil, then we don't have to explain in an ecological sense all these hangman trees and wolves in sheep's clothing, right? They are expressions of a fundamental malevolence. A similar principle applies to my third point, which is about dungeons, because if you assume that a dungeon is inhabited by a malevolent consciousness, whether it is that malevolent consciousness that built the dungeon or it just came along and inhabited it later, you can actually make a pretty cool dungeon out of this, because dungeons, unlike places where people actually live, are full of stuff that's fun to fight your players with traps and monsters and what have you. The dungeon intelligence can open and close doors to funnel the players and creatures into each other's company or funnel players into dangerous areas. And in fact, this would be a great explanation for traps. You know, I'm always complaining about things that kind of make no ecological sense, traps make extremely limited tactical sense. It's not that traps don't occur in real life, right? If you look at like guerrilla warfare, asymmetric warfare, traps are a thing that happens, even in a pre-explosives era. It's just that if you're using traps to protect your treasure, it's because you like traps. All right, you're Fred Jonesing it, because the reality is that traps are almost never as good as barriers, alarms, or guards. 9 times out of 10, you are better off with a bell that rings when someone hits a tripwire and all the hobgoblins can come running out with their spontoons and attack them than something that shoots darts at people when they hit a tripwire. Unless you are the building. You want to kill them with your own hands, your own quote-unquote hands. So spinning buzz saws and spike plates and whatever. Traps are fun, but from a strictly, like, who built this place perspective, they don't make a lot of sense. But if this is the place fighting you, then they actually start to make a lot of sense. Particularly if the building is trying to get you into its sacrificial spots, right? What if it needs to drink your blood so that you can rise again as a monster within its hallways? So with this legion of undead are all the people who've died in this place, whether brought there by the dungeon's cultists and sacrificed, or for your higher level types, your liches and your death knights and what have you, bold adventurers who once ventured into the dungeon in search of treasure. Maybe the treasure's real, but even so, it's something that the dungeon has, right? It built up a hoard at its center to bring people into it. Maybe your lower level, you know, your skeletons and your zombies, labor day and night, right? Quarrying blocks of stone to build new wings for the dungeon, expanding its presence. A dungeon spreading across the landscape or under the landscape like a cancer, tunneling out underneath people's very feet. A dungeon growing, linking up with other structures, spreading like a disease. I think that one's got legs. And I think particularly interesting, again, if you do it twice. So the first time you go in, you get the blue jewel, you come out, everyone rejoices. King gives you a big chest full of gold coins. Second time, later, nearby, but not in the same place, you run into some underground complex and gradually you're fighting all these skeletons and cultists and things. And you're starting to think, wait a minute, isn't this a bit like the last one? You know, we narrowly escaped that place with our lives. Poor old Eric the Cleric didn't make it at all. Can you hear laughter? So I think that there's definitely a potential to have the villain of a campaign, or at least of a particular scenario, be the dungeon itself. And I think that that's a lot of fun. I think it works for sort of temples, right? They could become animated by their gods. Many cultures believe that their gods literally dwelled within their temples. So, you know, imagine a being that was cut off from its higher plane. The only places on the prime material plane that it could go would be its own temples. Some brave paladin or some avenging deity went down and took out some archdevil, but at the last minute, it managed to flee out of its fortress in hell and into the only place in the prime material plane consecrated to its worship. And now it needs to build up its strength again so that it can finally replicate its own realm here in the prime material plane again, a literal hell on earth, or maybe accumulate enough power so that it can make its triumphant return to the lower realms. Though that's never a very compelling motivation for a villain, because very few players are concerned enough about what happens in literal hell to want to stop a demon from going back there, right? Like, he wants to leave the prime material plane to stop sacrificing people? Sounds great. Yeah, maybe it can't go back to the lower planes, and it can only turn part of our plane into its own home plane. It's heliforming the landscape. Okay, I like that. After all, if we are to accept that this part of the building or the landscape was corrupted by exposure to this supernatural menace, why shouldn't it happen again? Why shouldn't it spread? I think there's something to be done here with the customs, the ways in which people sanctify places. I spent a lot of time studying this when I was doing my PhD because the period that I studied was the period in which the idea of holy ground for burials started to become commonplace, at least in England. And in a lot of cultures around the world, there are places that are seen as being appropriate for sort of, you know, good burial and places that are seen as appropriate for bad burial, right? Think about the stereotype of like the murderer being buried at the crossroads or whatever. And then there are these kinds of in-between places where things are put that people aren't quite sure whether they're good or bad. I like the idea that those places take on the quality of who are buried there. I mean, this is me. Obviously, once we start getting into tombs and cemeteries, my little specialist eyes light up. But I think that they're good examples of how we create sacred spaces. We don't have formal cultural rituals for unholy spaces, but I bet that if you go to most communities and you ask them where, like, the bad place is, you could get a pretty reasonable consensus, right? People know where the unwholesome landscapes and the unwholesome buildings are. We can use those ways that people think about landscapes to design active landscapes in games that are fun. This has been kind of a high concept look at active landscapes as enemies, but I think that there's definitely something in it, and I actually think that I quite like the dungeon as infection idea. That's something that I will definitely put into a game at some point. I keep having the hankering to run a big heroic game. I'm currently running a very scoundrelly old school essentials game, so that need is being satisfied, but I keep wanting to run something very, very dramatic and elaborate. So yeah, I think there's something to be said there, you know, because this is a game that at heart is about exploring landscapes. And so when those landscapes are active, when those landscapes have consciousness, when those landscapes have goals, then that just enhances the experience of exploring them. You know, in a way, 5th edition sort of anticipates this with the idea of the layer action. Mechanically, it's kind of baked right into the game as it exists. Interesting. Now, what if you had a monster that was just all layer actions? All right, that's about all the psychically active landscapes that we have time for today. Bob, thank you very much for supporting Monster Man, and I hope that you enjoyed your episode. As I said before, if you'd like to be like Bob and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Or, if you prefer, you can pledge at a lower level. There's rewards for all of them. In our next episode, we're going to be returning to Creature Catalog, the 1986 supplement for Basic Dungeons & Dragons. And we're going to be talking about the Beholder, Aquatic, and the Brain Collector, right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.